Welcome to the Union of Egoists podcast. One of the greatest archivists of the individualist, anarchist, and egoist tradition is James J. Martin, who, beginning with his book Men Against the State, and continuing with his Libertarian Broadsides booklets and the books he published with the Libertarian Book Club of New York, was instrumental in creating a revived interest in writers like Benjamin R. Tucker and Max Stirner. It is my opinion that the 1963 Libertarian Book Club edition of The Ego and His Own is probably the second most important English language edition of Stirner's opus after the original 1907 edition, possibly followed by either Appio Ludd's new translation or the Cambridge edition. Today, I'm going to be presenting something very few of you have ever heard, which is selections from Jeff Riggenbach's audiobook recording of The Ego and His Own. It was originally released on an audio cassette edition by Laissez-Faire Audio, a division of libertarian Laissez-Faire Books that was started in New York City in 1972. Comprising a total of 10 tapes and released in 1994, I'm not aware of any subsequent release in any format since that time. There have been a few amateur attempts at recording the book, but none came close to Riggenbach's reading. I have produced this recording from a set of tapes donated to the Union of Egoists from Chip Smith, proprietor of Nine Banded Books, found at ninebandedbooks.com. I'm going to first start with a reading of the James J. Martin introduction. I will up and wander, swim and fancy free, in this big world that's inside me. Deep in my heart.
Editor's Introduction. 50 years sooner or later can make little difference in the case of a book so revolutionary as this. This was the opening sentence of James L. Walker's introduction to the first English-language issuance of Max Stirner's Der Einzige und sein Eigentum by Benjamin R. Tucker in 1907. It is probably as succinct and concise a summarization of the significance of the book as has ever been uttered. But Walker has not been the only one to speak of Stirner in this manner. 2 years later, James Huneker, in his famous evaluation, referred to the book as the most revolutionary ever written. He has left behind him a veritable breviary of destruction, a striking and dangerous book, Huneker declared. It is dangerous in every sense of the word, to socialism, to politicians, to hypocrisy. There is little doubt that The Ego and His Own is one of the most formidable assaults on authoritarianism ever launched. It may even belong in the first position as such. It is at once a historical document, a pamphlet of the intellectual disturbance of the mid-19th century, and a timeless classic. Its persistent reappearance in one language or another in the last 100 years testifies to the latter. However, the attention to Stirner has not been smooth and steady, but rather irregular and spasmodic. Its appearance in English for the first time was a product of one of these surges of interest, largely ignited by the great impact of Friedrich Nietzsche, especially between 1885 and 1910. As a consequence, Stirner was attached to the tail of Nietzsche's comet as a precursor, though he had been a comet in his own right before Nietzsche had even been old enough to learn to walk. The only biography of Stirner is John Henry Mackay, Max Stirner, Sein Leben und sein Werke, Berlin, 1898. It has not been translated into English. It remains the only significant source on Stirner. Paul Lauterbach, in his introduction to the 1892 Reclam edition of Der Einzige, thought it was ironic that Stirner dedicated his book to his second wife, Marie Dehnhardt, whose education, background, and interests hardly suggested she was capable of grasping more than a very scant portion of it. Lauterbach recalled the old Spanish saying, "Da Dios almendras al que no tiene muelas." God gives almonds to him who has no teeth. It is not of prime significance that Max Stirner's life be stressed here, though a few items of substance may be mentioned. He was born Johann Kaspar Schmidt in Bayreuth, Germany, on October 25, 1806. The name he adopted as a pseudonym was originally a nickname from student days, a reference to his broad, high forehead. His career prior to the writing of his first and major book was obscure, though it included education in three universities and half a dozen years' experience in teaching. His first wife died in childbirth in 1838, and he remarried in 1843, which also appears to be the date when he began to draw together his thoughts and material into the book which was to shock and outrage a goodly portion of intellectual Germany the year after, and subsequently the whole Western world. From internal evidence, it appears that he completed Der Einzige sometime in February or March 1844. A rather expert job of book production followed, for although the book bore the date 1845, it was actually in the hands of readers in November 1844. The Leipzig house of Otto Wiegand issued it in an octavo volume of about 500 pages. Stirner's book came out at a stormy time in Western and Central European affairs. France, Italy, and the whole German world were in furious distress caused by the pressure of liberalism upon the monarchical structure of politics in these lands, clamoring for a voice in the making of public policy and the running of affairs. And in the background and the underground boiled the propaganda of socialism, supervised by a score or more expert tenders of mainly French and German origin. The philosophical proponents of the powerful national secular state had also made their appearance, and the polished thought of Johann Gottlieb Fichte and Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, in particular the latter, had made a deep impression on the thinkers of the whole political spectrum of the time. In a way, Stirner was both a product and a victim of these factors. His book came out of them, and it was buried in the avalanche of the revolutions of March 1848 and thereafter. But in the interval between its publication and the uprising of the 48ers, a lively intellectual conflict spread. Few books have aroused such hostility and general disparagement as Stirner's, though it was not the author's intent to avoid a battle by any means. His spirited polemics against the principal figures among the so-called left Hegelians, the Jung Hegelianer, particularly Ludwig Feuerbach and Bruno Bauer, invited reprisal, let alone his equally rousing tilt with the socialists, especially Wilhelm Weitling and Moses Hess. Stirner represented a third force in these agitated times, neither a defender of the theological or monarchical state, nor a protagonist of the secular models advanced by the liberals and socialists. His views were as shocking and repellent to the latter as to the former. And Stirner went into almost total eclipse in the following 40 years, while the modern secular state took shape, with its distinctive homogenization of the new nationalism and socialism, and the surviving but mutated strains of the earlier divine right and ecclesiastical authority, plus the ingredients consisting of the enfranchised and compulsorily armed masses which the French Revolution contributed. Stirner's principal intellectual and social company had been the Berliners of Hegelian inspiration and tendencies, whom he had encountered at Hippel's restaurant, who were known as Die Freien in some circles. These bold spirits included Ludwig Buhl, C.F. Köppen, Arthur Müller, and the brothers Bruno, Edgar, and Egbert Bauer. And there were others. It was assumed Stirner was one of them, and the largest part of the critics in the subsequent half century generally lumped him in the Hegelian left. But Stirner's book is the anti-Hegel, as Victor Basch elaborated nearly 60 years ago. And in an important sense, a thorough reading and understanding of Hegel is necessary to understand Stirner. The assault on the master was not an explicit one, however. Hegel is mentioned sparingly, though significantly, in a direct sense. It is through his younger exponents that Stirner propels his critique of their state and its related personifications and generalized ideas. It was in the company of these persons that such previews of Stirner as exist made their appearance. He published a few articles in the Hallische Jahrbücher and the Deutsche Jahrbücher, ephemeral journals edited by Arnold Ruge in the years just previous. They were largely ignored at the time, and not made generally available for over half a century. It is in these that the germs of his anti-Hegelian revolt are first discerned. The history of Der Einzige und sein Eigentum is worthy of a glance. After its first appearance, it sank out of sight for nearly four decades. The original publishing house of Wiegand brought out a second edition in 1882 and a third in 1901. These latter two were separated chronologically by the 1892 Universal Bibliothek edition of Philipp Reclam, Jr., also of Leipzig, in the famous Miniatur Ausgaben series, which found Stirner in the company of world-famous literature. The publication of a full-scale biography of Stirner by John Henry Mackay in 1893 preceded two translations in French, which were published one after the other in Paris in 1900 under the title L'Unique et sa propriété. These set the stage for the English translation and publication. The first American to dwell at length on Stirner was James L. Walker, a Texas newspaper man and later physician, and an associate of Tucker. Walker brought Stirner's egoism into the pages of Tucker's world-famous anarchist weekly Liberty with increasing frequency during the 1890s, and himself prepared a strongly Stirner-influenced book, The Philosophy of Egoism, published posthumously, Walker having died in Mexico in 1904. His introduction to the Tucker edition of Stirner was written in 1902 or 1903, evidence that Tucker planned to release the book in that time, though some unknown circumstance delayed its issuance. In a publishing career which went back to 1875, Tucker insisted that making Stirner available in English was his most important contribution in the entire time. After Tucker's property was burned out in the fire of January 1908, his work ended. But apparently the plates of this book were salvaged, because editions in the identical format with that of 1907 came out in London and New York in 1913 through 1915 under different auspices, and a third by still another publisher was produced in New York in 1918. The history of Stirner's book in languages other than those examined above is obscure. There were Italian and Russian translations, and possibly in a Scandinavian language, as Stirner was very familiar to Henrik Ibsen and the Danish critic Georg Brandes, the latter having written at some length on Stirnerism. Huneker declared that the translation by the erudite philologist Stephen T. Byington was admirable, which is indeed a fact. He was aided in his work by Walker and by Emma Heller Schumm and George Schumm, all expert in German. So, in one sense, it was a cooperative project. Byington did the greater part of the work, however. His preface to the original edition is preserved here in order to illuminate some of the difficulties encountered in Stirner's frequently diffuse style, and his etymological references are preserved throughout the book in the original footnotes. His choice of the English title, The Ego and His Own, is specially felicitous. Friedrich Nietzsche was a few months old when Stirner's book was published, but no other thinker has been compared more to Stirner than Nietzsche, and perhaps with less evidence for it. A critical controversy raged among philosophers and academic people over this issue, in particular between 1890 and the First World War, and a literature of large enough scope exists on this subject alone to warrant a substantial book. Albert Levy, in his careful study Stirner et Nietzsche, points out that Stirner is not mentioned in either the works or the correspondence of Nietzsche at any time, and with the exception of a single instance, Nietzsche appears not to have been aware of him at all. In the case of every writer who has tried to establish such relationship, the method has consisted of dependence on inference and the coincidental similarities, which can be established by superficial content analysis. This is the approach of a considerable number of oversimplifiers, of whom Paul Karas is one of the best examples. Stirner was an uncommonly keen student of classical antiquity, the French Revolution, and the Bible in particular. The latter is his most quoted source by a wide margin. In one sense, this appears incomprehensible, considering Stirner's position on religion. Of this, more will be said shortly. An attempt has been made to annotate as many of Stirner's literary references and allusions as seems practicable, in view of their number and his careless documentation. The latter, in particular, suggests the contemporary polemic part of his book. The sources are thrown about carelessly like so much spare lumber, and the overall impression conveyed is that his readers are fully aware of their nature or have read them. The Ego and His Own is a piece of fierce writing, in an icy, relentless, epigrammatic style, as Huneker describes it. Nothing distracts Stirner from his pursuit of the exposition of freedom. He is for freedom for everyone, not just himself. And he is consistent in not shrinking from the consequences of this pursuit. It may very well be that the largest number of mid-20th century individualists does not have the stamina to stick with Stirner to the bitter logical end. The various libertarians are free to decamp at that point of the journey beyond where they no longer care to proceed. But it is their responsibility to know whence individualism stems and where its logic goes. No one has surpassed Stirner in dealing with these two aspects of the problem. There are uncanny portions of this work. One might cite in particular his discussion of the semantics of freedom and compare them with the similar dissertations by George Orwell in 1984 and Eugen Zamyatin in We, those most exquisitely anti-Stirner worlds. Stirner, in a sense, was a pioneer in the area of general semantics. Stirner wanted all to be free. He was not arguing just for himself or for a special segment of mankind. But he stressed over and over the part the one desirous of freedom had to play. Freedom was not something someone else gave you. All freedom is essentially self-liberation, says Stirner. His concern is with the individual rebel, not the revolution. It is as such that he respected Jesus, a rebel who concerned himself not a whit with the politics and the state of his time. But for organized Christianity, and for all other organized religions, Stirner had particularly harsh words. Personal insurrection, rather than general revolution, was his message. He recognized the futility of meeting the authorities at street barricades with broom handles at a time when the Romantics were still enamored with this concept. The age of automatic arms and instantaneous communication was just around the corner. The general revolution brought either socialism or a tyrant, in his view. The revolutionist merely exchanged masters, often for the worse. There are only 5 chapters in Stirner, 3 very short ones, separated by 2 very long ones. And it is in the latter that he has packed the very largest part of his message. Though he assaults religion, philosophy, morals, every source of inspiration for authority, as for his principal target, Victor Bache remarks, "L'État, voilà le grand ennemi, voilà l'éternel tyran du moi." All authority materials end up as arms and nutriment for the state, and Hegel and his chief disciples were the agents of his time who appeared to be doing the most thorough job of preparing the world for the new secular Leviathan. Stirner was scornful of the German national unity fervor of the 1840s. He was almost completely untouched by one of the most uproarious political fermentations in the history of Central Europe. In his view, unity would just be the superimposing of a far more grim and ferocious monster for the existing 38 separate weaker ones of the existing states. He saw no net gain in replacing the ecclesiastic or monarchical state with the new secular product in the making. In fact, he was sure that the latter had immeasurably superior means and capabilities for oppressiveness. But if Stirner was appalled by the Hegelians, he was equally appalled by the communists. The Ego and His Own was a pitiless attack on communism well before the Communist Manifesto was published, and it is at the same time one of the most original and unanswerable critiques of coercive collectivism. A social associate of Friedrich Engels, published in one of the journals edited by Karl Marx, Stirner's socialist antagonists were Weitling and Hess, and the French propounders of the same ideology, all more prominent at that moment. Stirner saw clearly through the communist appeals of the 1840s, the seedbed of the manifesto, in particular the talk of the necessity of eliminating the state. He reiterated that communism would produce instead a state far more onerous than the royal, ecclesiastic, or bourgeois models communists fulminated against so tirelessly. Yet Stirner does not talk of future societies or blueprints for them himself. For the most part, he avoids all soothsaying. The structure of the free Union is beyond his ken, and he felt it was a futile field for prediction in the first place. As he says in one place of the slave, and the speculations as to his likely behavior once his servitude is ended, one cannot know what he will do until he actually gets free. The century coinciding roughly with the end of the Second World War may be described ideologically as the Age of Marx, during which Marxism was presumed to be victorious over Stirner and all other antagonists. The fact that Marx devoted such an immense part of his ponderous Die Deutsche Ideologie to an attack on Stirner was conceded to be the principal prima facie evidence of the former's triumph. A generation ago, Sidney Hook, in two widely acclaimed books, calmly reaffirmed that Marx demolished Der Einzige und sein Eigentum, it being nothing but a social defense mechanism of a petty bourgeois soul. Marxists long tended to display this cavalier attitude toward Stirner, generally without reading a line of his work. In fact, Marxist literary and intellectual influence for a time all but brought about Stirner's consignment to the memory hole of 1984 fame. But there is plentiful evidence that he, Proudhon, Bakunin, and the others against whom Marx tilted never lost their validity during this period. The last two decades in particular have seen the repeated reappearance of their works in various forms. As Herbert Read declared in his masterful essay commemorating the centennial of Stirner's book, after a sleep of 100 years, the giants whom Marx thought he had slain show signs of coming to life again, and indeed they have returned. Marx's criticism of Stirner, Read advanced in a famous second thought, would need drastic revision to be convincing today. As for critics of Stirnerite egoism such as Berdyaev, Read was of the view that Stirner could have handled him capably with a single sentence. Concerning Stirner's examination of love and his consistent plea in behalf of the integration of personality, Read concludes with several impressive observations. He finds many modern views in such areas as held by Erich Fromm, Jung, Martin Buber, and even the existentialists in very close rapport with, if not dependent on, Max Stirner. The fashionable day for ad hominem attacks on Stirner seems past. The ego and his own has demonstrated survival value. It deserves to be read in the same spirit and in the same way one reads The Prince. James J. Martin, Malibu, California, September 8, 1962.
Now I'm going to play the wonderful preamble translated here as All Things Are Nothing to Me. If you have not obtained a copy of the journal Der Geist, published by the Union of Egoists, I highly recommend doing so. Related to this recording, in the first issue, we've published an alternate, an earlier translation of the preamble by an H.J. Schirmer that appeared in the journal Age of Thought, published in July 1897, a full decade before Byington's edition was released. In it, we found the title of the preamble rendered as, I've based my cause upon nothing. Schirmer's translation is the first Englishing of Stirner's work of any substantive length.
All things are nothing to me. What is not supposed to be my concern? First and foremost, the good cause, then God's cause, the cause of mankind, of truth, of freedom, of humanity, of justice. Further, the cause of my people, my prince, my fatherland. Finally, even the cause of mind and 1,000 other causes. Only my cause is never to be my concern. Shame on the egoist who thinks only of himself. Let us look and see, then, how they manage their concerns, they for whose cause we are to labor, devote ourselves, and grow enthusiastic. You have much profound information to give about God, and have, for thousands of years, searched the depths of the Godhead and looked into its heart, so that you can doubtless tell us how God himself attends to God's cause, which we are called to serve. And you do not conceal the Lord's doings either. Now, what is his cause? Has he, as is demanded of us, made an alien cause, the cause of truth or love, his own? You are shocked by this misunderstanding, and you instruct us that God's cause is indeed the cause of truth and love, but that this cause cannot be called alien to him, because God is himself truth and love. You are shocked by the assumption that God could be like us poor worms in furthering an alien cause as his own. Should God take up the cause of truth if he were not himself truth? He cares only for his cause. But because he is all in all, therefore all is his cause. But we are not all in all, and our cause is altogether little and contemptible. Therefore, we must serve a higher cause. Now, it is clear God cares only for what is His, busies Himself only with Himself, thinks only of Himself, and has only Himself before His eyes. Woe to all that is not well-pleasing to Him! He serves no higher person, and satisfies only Himself. His cause is a purely egoistic cause. How is it with mankind, whose cause we are to make our own? Is its cause that of another, and does mankind serve a higher cause? No. Mankind looks only at itself. Mankind will promote the interests of mankind only. Mankind is its own cause. That it may develop, it causes nations and individuals to wear themselves out in its service, and when they have accomplished what mankind needs, it throws them on the dung heap of history in gratitude. Is not mankind's cause a purely egoistic cause? I have no need to take up each thing that wants to throw its cause on us and show that it is occupied only with itself, not with us, only with its good, not with ours. Look at the rest for yourselves. Do truth, freedom, humanity, justice, desire anything else than that you grow enthusiastic and serve them? They all have an admirable time of it when they receive zealous homage. Just observe the nation that is defended by devoted patriots. The patriots fall in bloody battle or in the fight with hunger and want. What does the nation care for that? By the manure of their corpses, the nation comes to its bloom. The individuals have died for the great cause of the nation, and the nation sends some words of thanks after them, and has the profit of it. I call that a paying kind of egoism. But only look at that sultan who cares so lovingly for his people. Is he not pure unselfishness itself, and does he not hourly sacrifice himself for his people? Oh yes, for his people. Just try it. Show yourself not as his, but as your own. For breaking away from his egoism, you will take a trip to jail. The sultan has set his cause on nothing but himself. He is to himself all in all. He is to himself the only one, and tolerates nobody who would dare not to be one of his people. And will you not learn by these brilliant examples that the egoist gets on best? I, for my part, take a lesson from them, and propose, instead of further unselfishly serving those great egoists, rather to be the egoist myself. God and mankind have concerned themselves for nothing but themselves. Let me, then, likewise, concern myself for myself, who am equally with God, the nothing of all others, who am my all, who am the only one. If God, if mankind, as you affirm, have substance enough in themselves to be all in all to themselves, then I feel that I shall still less lack that, and that I shall have no complaint to make of my emptiness. I am not nothing in the sense of emptiness, but I am the creative nothing, the nothing out of which I myself as creator create everything. Away then with every concern that is not altogether my concern. You think at least the good cause must be my concern? What's good? What's bad? Why, I myself am my concern, and I am neither good nor bad. Neither has meaning for me. The divine is God's concern, the human man's. My concern is neither the divine nor the human, not the true, good, just, free, etc., but solely what is mine, and it is not a general one, but is unique, as I am unique. Nothing is more to me than myself.
Of note, we expect to release a second issue of Der Geist Journal later this year, and almost every month sees a new installment of the standalone journal series. Keep up with things going on at unionofegoists.com.
Hooray! Hooray for hate! cousin Doris. I hate to go to bed. I hate those little squishy things they stick in baked nut bread. I hate to kiss my uncle. I hate these stupid shoes. I hate to play a game when there's a chance that I might lose. I hate to eat my vegetables. I hate to sit and write. But mostly I hate grown-up being. It's not fair to hate. I hate my cousin Doris. I hate to go to bed. I hate those little squishy things like stick and baked nut bread. I hate to kiss my uncle. I hate these stupid shoes. I hate to play a game when there's a chance that I might lose.